Welcome to Scientifica, the premier podcast where the latest scientific discoveries are discussed in the context of their apologetic significance to the Christian faith.
This is Average Joe Aguirre, joined today by members of our scholar team, biochemist Fuzz Rana, astrophysicist Jeff Swearing, and molecular biologist Anjanette Roberts. Hugh Ross is off today. They will be sharing exciting research from the front lines of the scientific journals and discussing the apologetic implications. You will hear from each in roundtable fashion today. Actually, AJ is going to be chiming in on the other two discoveries. Welcome to each of you. We did not toss the dice today. In fact, Fuzz, your discovery is going to be a little bit longer, so we have put Jeff at the front of the line. I determined that because Jeff's going to be talking about time anyway. In fact, Jeff, you're going to be talking about autonomous quantum clocks. So it just makes sense that since Fuzz is going to be taking a lot of time and you're talking about clocks, we have a clock right here, Jeff.
You betcha.
But it's not a quantum clock, but I suspect that yours has to do with somehow the physics of the universe. You're going to bring that into play here. Maybe a good place to start is, what is an autonomous quantum clock? And then you're going to bring that around to the physics of the universe, so on and so forth. And then we'll get into Fuzz's discovery a little bit later.
Well, I hope it's as interesting as you describe it there. So this is one of those discoveries that I was reading about, and I kind of got the basic gist of what they were talking. And what they've done is they've developed this model of an atomic or a quantum clock, where they were using this to investigate how thermodynamics relates to the precision and the resolution, or the accuracy and the resolution of a clock. And so this is trying to probe the fundamental limits. How well can we measure time? Are there any limitations on it? What are the limitations on it? And so they developed this model of a clock where you've got a hot bath and a cold bath. And as heat flows from the hot bath to the cold bath, an electron or something of that nature is moving up to higher and higher energy levels. And once it goes through so many energy levels, once it gets up to the top of the ladder, if you will, it relatively quickly decays and emits a photon, and that's a ticking of the clock. And then the whole process starts over. And this, if I'm honest, I sat there and I read that. I thought, oh, that's cool. I'm like, I thought they'd actually built this. And it turns out it's a computer model.
Oh.
But I thought, you know, I mean, to be able to build something like that would be fascinating. And so I hope they actually do something like this. But the neat thing about this particular model is that, one, it's just fundamentally very simple. I mean, you got a hot bath, you got a cold bath, you've got these different energy levels in an atom. The electron is pumped up through those energy levels, and once it gets up high enough, it decays and emits a photon. It's a conceptually very simple model, which means that they can, in their model of that clock, they can account for everything. So that's the autonomous. There's the clock just works in and of itself. There's no external input to it, so you're not adding heat or energy or any sort of thing like that. And what they were then able to do, given that it was just autonomous and operated by itself, didn't require any external inputs or any fine-tuning and developing it, because other people had built clocks where with a certain initial condition, you could get the clock to run. So you had these very precisely tuned states. This is just hot bath, cold bath, atom with certain energy levels. When the electron gets high enough, it decays and emits a photon. That's when the clock ticks.
Don't you have to have some kind of energy input to keep the hot bath hot?
That's not the discussion we're at yet. So I'll get to that in just a second. That's kind of one of those takeaway points. So I'll come back around to that. But what they were able to do is then measure or model that system, and then they could say, all right, well, as we increase the resolution, or if we want to increase the resolution, or if we want to increase the accuracy of the clock, we can do various things. But what they were able to find, which in some sense is surprising and in some sense is not surprising, is that the accuracy and the resolutions are trade-offs, and both of them, the more the larger the temperature difference between the hot bath and the cold bath, the greater resolution and or accuracy you can get. But that accuracy and resolution are kind of And when you get down at that fundamental level, they're actually kind of complementary, or I'm drawing a blank on it.
Negatively correlated?
No, there's a specific quantum mechanical term that I just drew a blank on, that they're not Hermitian. They don't commute, that you can't just flip and flap them back and forth, which means that when you take the uncertainty in one and the uncertainty in the other, there's some minimum level that you can't get lower than. Or stated another way, that as you push the uncertainty down for the resolution, the uncertainty and the accuracy is going to go up. Or if you push the uncertainty and the accuracy down, the uncertainty and the resolution is going to go up. And so, this is kind of a particular, a quantum mechanical effect that shows up in terms of position and momentum have that same sort of relationship, or energy and time have that same sort of relationship. And so, in some sense, from a quantum mechanical system, it's not surprising that you get this. But I just think it has a couple of interesting, draws attention to a number of interesting features. And I think one of those first features is that the ability to tell time is fundamentally tied to things being out of equilibrium, which is a statement of how long can time actually be measured, how long can time actually operate in that sense. That eventually, as the entropy of the universe continues to increase, everything is going to come to thermodynamic equilibrium. And at that point in time, you have no more clocks, no more life, no more nothing. And so it's, this is a demonstration, to the extent that the model is correct, that there's a lifespan to our universe. Now, I will say in very practical terms, the lifespan of when these clocks are going to become physically impossible is long, measured in trillions of years, not even just billions, certainly not millions. So this is a very long time scale. But nonetheless, it does show that there's a limit to how long this universe can support life, can support time, those sorts of things. It's also interesting because time is one of those fundamental quantities, if you will. I mean, that we look at it as a very fundamental quantity, that you talk about the dimensions of space, space-time. You've got three large spatial dimensions, one time dimension. That in a very real sense, everything about the way we think has this time component to it. But time is not actually a fundamental quantity. It's something that you actually have to measure or infer. It's not, you can't look at a system and say, how much time is there? I mean, it's an inferred quantity that is really related to the fact that the entropy of our universe was much lower in the past, and it's steadily growing over time, which is interesting in this sense, that you look at a lot of religions and time is cyclical. In a very real sense, it's eternal. And so it kind of goes and it circles back and everything kind of resets and it just goes on forever. Whereas from the very first verse of the Bible, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, that this time is not only not an eternal or it's not a fundamental quantity, it's a created quantity or a derived quantity, but it has a beginning and things go from here to here to here to here to here. That's the way the Bible describes things. And lo and behold, when we measure how the universe behaves, that's what we see, which to a physicist is also very interesting, because when you look at the equations that describe how physics operates, those don't have a direction in time to them. So when I write down an equation, just even how is the ball going to move? If you specify the velocity and I specify the position, I can tell you where that ball will be at any point in time. The ball has no memory of, oh, that was the past, that was the future. Only because of this increase in entropy do we have that sense of time being forward and backwards. So the fundamental description of physics we have doesn't have a before and after, or it has before and after, but it doesn't have past and future. Whereas that's very much how we experience it, and that's how the Bible describes it as well. And I just find that an interesting connection, because we kind of take it for granted that time behaves that way, but it need not. And an interesting aspect is, just kind of tying it back to an article that I wrote on the web a number of years ago. It's called Built-In Causality Does Something to Ensure a Stable Universe. But effectively, there was a different study that I was reporting on where scientists were trying to take quantum pieces and build up a space-time. And what they found were some kind of interesting results. One was that if they just put these pieces of space-time and let them kind of assemble and accumulate together, universes like ours were not stable. I mean, they wouldn't be built. But when they put in causality, and causality means that this effect leads to this result, that there's a direction of time about it, then you get large, stable, large universes like ours. And so this idea of causality and a direction of time seems very fundamental to how our universe behaves. And it's the it's how the Bible describes our universe in juxtaposition to a lot of religions. Their description of things is very different than that. And at the end of the day, there's going to be an end of the day. There is no, this can't just happen forever given the way the universe is constituted. Mm-hmm. I thought there's just some kind of interesting apologetic implications there, but I really do want them to actually build this clock. That would be a phenomenal experimental achievement if we could do something like that.
Yeah. Jeff, I have a real basic lay question. When we talk about clocks, how do we start knowing when time began and, when the Bible says in the beginning, the universe, God created the heavens and the earth, who determined when that was, and how did the first dating begin, and how do we determine clocks in the universe? There are all kinds of clocks, right?
You're right.
When you look at your watch, for example, who figures all that out, and who has been doing that?
Well, that's about 12 different questions.
I know.
So I'll address.
Help the lay people for a minute here, then we can go on to AJ's questions.
So in essence, what a clock is something that repeats regularly. You can use as a clock, and so in this particular clock, the electron moves up and decays, and it does that in a pretty regular fashion. And so the greater the flow of energy, the more regular it's going to be. The more steps there are, the more regular it's going to be, or the more resolution it's going to be, the more resolution it will have. And so there are stars that fluctuate back or pulsate in their light that can be used as clocks.
We speak of metabolic clocks.
Yeah, well,
right?
I mean, so you just hang a ball from a string, and it's going to swing back and forth at a very, or if you have it swing with a small enough amplitude, it will be very regular in its time, and so or in how long it takes to sweep out one period. And so there's lots of different things you could use. The question is, how accurate are these things? And so as we've started developing clocks, which is actually a very recent phenomenon, this is, like a couple hundred years type things where they've been accurate enough to do really good timing. You just keep looking for clocks that are more and more reliable, things that where magnetic and temperature and all these other influences are smaller and smaller, and so you can record time more and more accurately that way. And now, I mean, we use vibrations of certain atoms and certain elements in certain systems. It's a very, very esoteric, very detailed, very specific field at this point. But all of that is just to get more and more accurate time with higher and higher resolution. And again, both of those kind of compete against each other, because the more and more resolution you have, the harder it is to keep track of every single oscillation that you have. So that's kind of a roundabout answer of saying anything that's regular can keep time. The more specific or the more accurate you want to be with your time, or the better resolution you want to have with your time, requires more and more tuning to make sure that it behaves as reliably as you can.
Yeah. Here's a kind of a philosophical question for any of you, really. Are there people, say, in Asia, for example, who would hold to reincarnation and are physicists at the same time? And if so, how would they reconcile the two?
I would say yes, there are. And I don't know how all of them would, but I know I had a conversation with a colleague a number of years back where we were kind of talking about Christianity and whether things were true. And he made a comment that contradictions are just part of the world. And so it doesn't really matter whether reincarnation's true or whether you're a physicist. In some sense, he just saw this as playing a very elaborate game, that there's a very well-specified set of rules of how you do science. And you did that, and that wasn't in or the fact that things might have contradicted really wasn't a problem in his worldview, which for a Christian, it's like, how do you do that? If you've got contradictions, that's a sign that your worldview is wrong. And so there's part of that that was just inherent in their worldview, that things were going to be contradictory, and that wasn't a problem. So I don't know how all of them would answer that, but I know some very, historically and personally, I know some very talented physicists who are Indian who would have that sort of background, but that wasn't a problem for them.
Okay. All right. Interesting stuff.
Now, I did actually. I remember you asked a question of how did we determine the first time or whatever. And I think think you're referring to that as when did we just start developing clocks.
Yeah.
But I do think that's an interesting question from the standpoint of how do we know there's a beginning to the universe? Because you asked the question, you know, there is no clock out there that started ticking when the universe came into existence.
Right.
So how do you determine, that's T equals zero?
Yeah.
And that's an interesting question because I was looking into that when I was looking at the space-time theorems of general relativity. You know, we talk about, the space-time theorems of general relativity show that there's a beginning to the universe. And so I'm like, okay, how did they do, what was the actual physical measurement there? And it turns out that what had happened is as Hawking and Penrose were looking at trajectories of things in the context of general relativity as you ran the universe backwards, eventually it came to a place where the laws of physics broke down. And where the laws of physics broke down, that was T equals zero in their book. Now, since then, there's others who've come along and said, well, if you get a quantum theory of gravity, the laws of physics don't break down. But there's this place where everything gets squished to a maximum and you wipe out all past information. And so, okay, that's T equals zero. And so conceptually or practically speaking, when you're talking about the beginning of the universe, thinking about what is that definition of T equals zero or how do you make that measurement, it's actually a very interesting question that I've really enjoyed looking at. And it's not just, you can't say, that's T equals zero there. It's actually requires some philosophical thought to determine what does the beginning actually look like from a physical, how would we measure that perspective. So,
okay, very good. Thank you for that, Jeff. All right, on this, unless you guys have any more questions, we will switch it over to Fuzz. Fuzz, I guess the junk DNA wars are heating up. Is that a good way to characterize it?
Oh, they certainly are heating up. Yes.
I think you've been writing and talking about junk DNA for years now, and just when I was safely in my cocoon thinking that this has been resolved, boy, things have really gone the other way, apparently, but you're going to bring us back into sanity, I hope, or are you going to muddy the waters further?
Well, I hope not to muddy the waters, but, you know, I've got that special talent to do that. So, but, you know, what I want to talk about today is a paper published in a journal called Genome Biology and Evolution, and the article is an advanced online article. It'll appear in print in the near future, but it's written by a evolutionary biologist at the University of Houston named Dan Grar. And I'm sure most of our listeners probably are not familiar with his name, but if you're not, you should be, because he is one of the leading, if not the most prominent, critics of the ENCODE project results. And so this article that he's published in Genome Biology and Evolution is the latest salvo in attacks coming from him against the ENCODE project.
So he has a history of this kind of work.
Yes, he does. And his work is essentially a modeling study in which he argues, based on his modeling work, that the human genome cannot have a functional fraction that is greater than 25%. In fact, it must be closer to 10 or 15%. And of course, this is in contrast to what the ENCODE project claims, which is at minimum 80% of the human genome is functional, with the idea being that that number very well will trend upward closer to 100% as more work is done in trying to identify functional elements in the human genome. And of course, this is a very important debate. What is the fraction of functional DNA in the human genome for scientific reasons? But it also has profound implications for the creation-evolution debate, because historically, one of the most prominent and presumably compelling arguments for the evolutionary origin of humanity was the large fraction of junk DNA in our genome. When the draft sequence for the human genome was reported in 2001, something like that, yeah. Anyway, the estimates at that point were that probably 95% of the human genome is junk. But that really has changed over the last decade with the publication of phase two of the ENCODE project that showed at minimum 80% of the human genome is functional, with, again, phase three results, again, pushing that number higher, presumably. And, of course, that solves this problem. Why would God create a genome that would be littered with garbage DNA, particularly since some of those sequences are shared with chimps and gorillas and orangutans. It seems like that provides really very compelling evidence for our evolutionary history. But if that DNA is actually functional, then it allows a very, I think, potent response to that evolutionary claim, and actually makes the genome appear to have the fingerprints of a creator's handiwork. So this is really a very important issue. Now, what's fascinating to me is that as soon as the ENCODE project results were published, it ignited a maelstrom of controversy that has been dubbed the junk DNA wars, as you've alluded to.
Oh, I didn't even know it was called that.
Carl Zimmer is the one who coined that term. He's a science writer in an article published a couple of years ago in the New York Times. And I've actually written a series of articles that are kind of delineating the controversy surrounding the interpretation of the ENCODE project results. And if people go to our website and they type in ENCODE in all caps, and they'll come across a whole ensemble of articles that they can read to get the background into the criticisms of the ENCODE project. But this is a controversy that isn't between creationist / intelligent design proponents and evolutionary biologists. This is an internal controversy within science between evolutionary biologists and scientists that are involved in genomics. Because the evolutionary biologists are basically saying, in not so many words, that if the ENCODE project results are correct, then it means fundamental aspects of the evolutionary paradigm could not be true. And we all know that evolution is true. Therefore, the results of the ENCODE project simply cannot be correct. Whereas scientists working in genomics are arguing, but the results of the ENCODE project are extremely valuable in trying to identify genetic associations and the genetic etiology of diseases. So you have two very differing perspectives on the value and the credibility of the ENCODE project.
So can you explain why, if the ENCODE project is right, that there's, which I gather is just that there's a significant, 80%+ of the genome is functional in some sense.
Right.
Why is that incompatible with evolutionary theory?
It has to do with the mechanism by which the structures in the genome are generated. It has to do with the theoretical framework that accounts for junk DNA and the resolution of what's called the C-value paradox, which is the idea that genomes from organism to organism vary in size and don't have any reflection on the complexity of the organism. And so there are things like that that are kind of intertwined in the evolutionary framework that suddenly don't have explanation if the ENCODE project is
okay,
considered valid.
So it's more, or it's not just simply that having that much functional would be inconsistent with natural selection and random mutations and stuff. It's that in that you need to have a lot of unused DNA to answer other problems, the C value paradox, which is that genome sizes are significantly different in size, but the organisms are relatively similar complex.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So that makes sense.
That would be one example.
Okay.
And
but it's a really intuitive and insightful question that you asked, Jeff, I think, because what we find, right, if the ENCODE data starts to become the established paradigm, then it's not going to be contrary to evolutionary theory. We're going to be able to explain it via an evolutionary paradigm. It's just not the current interpretation of what we observe in the genomes.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
So it's an insightful question.
Yeah. Now, and the ENCODE project critics have presented a litany of technical criticisms against the project. And again, in articles that are on our website, I respond to some of these technical concerns. But the criticism has actually gone beyond technical critique of the work. It actually has become personal. And so the ENCODE project critics in the scientific literature have leveled some pretty substantial charges against the competency of scientists working on the ENCODE project, that the project was poorly designed, they don't understand the basics of evolutionary theory, things like that. So it really has become a rather vitriolic debate within the scientific community. And that in and of itself should be rather telling, because that level of emotional investment goes beyond a typical scientific debate. And that emotional investment traces back again to this idea that if ENCODE is correct, that means fundamental tenets of evolutionary biology simply cannot be correct. And that is where that emotional energy is coming from, and the types of criticisms that are being leveled against the ENCODE scientist. And so this paper by Dan Graur is just the latest in that whole, in that battlefield operation that you see going on. And what he's doing in this study is he's trying to calculate the percentage of functional DNA in the human genome in the face of what is called mutational load. That is, when mutations occur in DNA, some of those mutations will be harmful or deleterious, and that will create a load within the genome. And so he's arguing that if you take basically the rate of deleterious mutations and you look at the mutational load, what is the fraction of the genome that must be non-functional to buffer or to function like a sponge absorbing those deleterious mutations to allow for a sufficient level of fitness to maintain a constant population size. So in other words, when deleterious mutations arise and they are occurring in functional parts of the genome, if they're non-functional parts of the genome, then they're technically not deleterious mutations. When deleterious mutations arise, they minimize the function, the fitness of the organism. They minimize the reproductive fecundity of the organism. And so that means that to maintain a constant population size, you have to have more offspring. And so he argues that historically, the replacement level fertility rate to maintain a population size was about 2 to 3 children per couple. That's historically a number that he's produced to do his modeling work with. And then he argued, if that's the case, then you have to have somewhere between 75 and about 90% of the human genome being non-functional to absorb those deleterious mutations to permit constant population size in human beings. Now, he argues that if you go to an 80% functional genome, then at minimum, that couple would have to have 15 kids to maintain a constant population size. And if you go to 100% functional genome, you'd have to have 24 children per couple minimally. And
so this is historically?
No, this is based on his model.
Oh, I see.
And so he's arguing that given that the rate historically is 2 to 3 offspring per couple, that the only result that makes sense is that about 10 to 15% of the human genome is functional, the rest is non-functional. Mm.
So you've got the ENCODE project, which went and said, we're going to measure these molecular or these markers of genetic activity. And when they made those measurements, they say 80% or whatever the number is functional. And then this Graur and others are coming along in this particular study saying, given our model of or how evolutionary theory works, in order to have the reproductive success that we've had, the genome can only be or can be no more than 20% functional or whatever the numbers you're throwing at there. So you've got these two different measures of the same property that are giving different results.
Right.
Okay.
And for the ENCODE project, what they did is there were 6 assays. One of them measured transcription of the genome, how much of that genome was used to generate RNA molecules.
Mm-hmm.
They looked at binding of transcription factors, which would be proteins that bind to DNA that are kind of like turning the genes on and off.
Mm-hmm.
There's histone binding and modified histone binding as 2 separate assays. And then there was an assay measuring 3-dimensional structure. And there was one other assay that was measured, and I can't remember what it was off the top of my head. But there were 6 assays that they measured that were well thought out assays that were measuring things that, you know, you would ascribe normally to function in the genome. And so, you know, the ENCODE results are, again, experimentally determined. Now, what do we do with Dan Graur's claims here? Well, I've got.
Can I just ask one clarifying question about Dan Grar's model? So he's modeling only reproductive fecundity and fitness. So he's not considering a deleterious mutation, something that is suboptimal in operation. It's basically a lethal mutation.
I'll get to that in a second, because that's one of my criticisms of his work.
Okay.
So I'll get to that in a second. But the first point that I want to make, and again, I got a series of responses here that I'll try to go through quickly. The first point that I want to make, and I make this with some measure of hesitation, but I think it's actually really important to make, and that is you cannot think of Dan Grar as being an objective scientist looking to assess function in the human genome. He's an outspoken atheist who, out of his atheism, seems to be motivated in criticizing the ENCODE project. It's not just simply a technical critique. There's a deeper worldview issue undergirding his criticism. And this is not simply me making this assertion. This is actually something that other scientists have pointed out in responding to some of the criticisms that Dan Grar has leveled against the ENCODE project. So, for example, let's see here. In 2013, a scientist by the name of John Maddock, who's a very well-known molecular biologist who views the ENCODE project results favorably, wrote this in an article, essentially, again, assessing functionality in the human genome and then responding to some of the criticisms of Dan Grar. And he says this. It's a little bit of a lengthy quote, but this is very telling. "There may also be another factor motivating Grar and related articles, which is suggested by the sources and selection of quotations used at the beginning of the article, as well as in the use of the phrase evolution-free gospel in its title. The argument of a largely non-functional genome is invoked by some evolutionary theorists in the debate against the proponents of intelligent design of life on Earth, particularly with respect to the origin of humanity. In essence, the argument posits that the presence of non-protein coding or so-called junk DNA that comprises greater than 90% of the human genome is evidence for the accumulation of evolutionary debris by blind Darwinian evolution and argues against intelligent design, as an intelligent designer would presumably not fill the human genetic instruction set with meaningless information. This argument is threatened in the face of growing functional indices of non-coding regions of the genome, with the latter reciprocally used in support of the notion of intelligent design and to challenge the conception that natural selection accounts for the existence of complex organisms." John Maddock is not an intelligent design proponent. He probably is deeply entrenched in the evolutionary paradigm himself. But here he's observing that the extent of Grar's criticism is so extreme that he's wondering if his motivation is not scientific, but actually is driven by worldview considerations. And in fact, in this article in Genome Biology and Evolution, Grar says this: "This situation becomes more absurd with respect to 100% of the genome being functional. This situation becomes more absurd and untenable if we assume that the entire genome is functional as proclaimed by creationists such as Francis Collins, director of the National Institutes of Health." Okay, Francis Collins is not a creationist. He's an evangelical Christian, but he's not a creationist. But Collins, as an evolutionary creationist, has argued that he was wrong and others were wrong, that the genome is actually comprised of significant amount of functional DNA. And for Grar, that brought Collins into the target zone, right? And he labels him as a creationist for simply arguing that the genome is functional. And elsewhere I've heard him actually deride Collins's competence as a scientist because of that. But this right away is telling you that the motivation of Grar in critiquing the ENCODE project is not pure. It's not a pure motivation. It's actually driven by something. And
if I could make a comment, and I've not looked at this particular instance, and I trust what your assessment and everything is here, but to me this is also a challenge or a warning to Christians, as we're arguing for for a creator is that there are times where sometimes the data argues against your argument.
Yes.
Doesn't it argue against the creator, but it argues against the argument that you like, or it doesn't align with the argument you like. And, you know, I recall a number of years ago when, you know, as the evidence started to grow for the multiverse, you know, I've made statements where for a time there, I just thought, well, maybe we lose the design argument because the multiverse not being inconsistent with God, it removes the weight of that argument as being a decider between the two.
Right.
And, you know, I caught a reasonable bit of flack from that. And I still hear people bring that up and throw it out as a criticism that, you know, at the end of the day, I think you still have a design argument, but we have to be willing to say, all right, this may not, the data gets to decide the truth there, not what I want for my argument specifically. So,
well said, Jeff. Well said. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. You know, and just another quick Dan Graur story. I've never met him. All I know of him is what I've read in his technical journal articles. But a few years ago, I was one of the faculty members at the RZIM Summer School in Canada, in Toronto, Canada. And I gave a plenary talk and a couple of breakout talks. And after one of my talks, a young lady came up to me who is a student at the University of Houston. And she's not a scientist or a science major, but she had to take an introductory biology course. And she said, your talk was really encouraging to me because I took a biology course and my professor was just the nastiest person in the world. He would come to class and he would go out of his way to ridicule Christians that were in the class. And she goes, it just was very encouraging me to hear your evidence from biology for a creator and your perspective on the evidence. And I said, you know, let me ask you a question. Your professor isn't Dan Graur, is she? Or is he? And she looked at me and she couldn't believe I knew who he was. And she goes, how did you know? And I said, I've never met him, but I've read his journal articles. And I know that he's at the University of Houston. And I just thought, was it Dan Graur? So the point here is, again, I want to be careful not to just simply dismiss his work because of this, but this is a factor. This is something to consider mm-hmm. when you get to criticisms that are that extreme. And, you know, as Jeff was pointing out, the results of the ENCODE project are experimentally determined in terms of function. Dan Graur's assessment or criticisms of the ENCODE project are all model-driven and theoretical.
They're all paradigm-driven models, right? Paradigm-driven modeling.
Exactly right. And this gets to my another criticism, which is a question you asked earlier about the methodology. I have some issues with the methodology.
Absolutely.
Now, I don't know enough about population genetics to go in there and assess the nitty-gritty details of the modeling work he did, but I can look at the assumptions. And the first assumption is the definition of function. The definition of function that Graur uses is a highly restrictive definition. It's called a selected effect definition, which basically means regions of the genome are only considered functional if they're under negative selection, meaning that they must be so important that natural selection cannot change those regions, because if it did, it would lead to the death of the organism. And so that definition is a theory-laden definition that is embedded in the evolutionary framework, and it's a highly restricted definition. And he actually derides biologists who would employ what's called a causal role definition, namely that if you can show through cause and effect relationships that parts of the genome is actually doing something, that's not considered functional. Why? Because according to Graur, it's ahistorical and non-evolutionary. But yet, everything I've ever done as a scientist employs as a causal role definition of function, where does it do something? If it does, it's functional, particularly if what it does has relevance to what's happening inside the organism. So he's adopting this extremely narrow view of function, and right away that's going to eliminate a significant proportion of potential functionality in the genome for definitional purposes alone.
It seems like his position on that point is actually very destructive for the reliability of scientific findings, for scientific evidence. I mean, if he's basically not saying that functional assays are enough to convince him that it's true or that it's significant in assessing something, then basically his criteria for for attacking that position is actually destructive to the entire process of science.
That's an extremely excellent point, because he's actually saying the experimental method has no role in this. Modeling is the, you know, or what we can determine rationally is what's important.
Yeah, now, you know, I find that interesting, and I'll just say it a different way, because, you know, this, if you read my work, you'll notice this tension that I often wrestle with is that, you know, when you look at habitable planets or various numbers of things, we can always say, well, this number of planets aren't habitable, these fractions are. And what always troubles me in that is that those are, in some sense, very model-driven. You know, we say, okay, we got to model the atmospheres, we got to model this, model that, model the other. I guarantee that if we ever find a signature of life on another planet and it contradicts the model, nobody's going to go and say, oh, that data is wrong. I mean, they'll go and investigate it and make sure that the data is legitimately done. But nobody's going to say, we don't trust the data because our model says that can't happen.
No, and
what they're
going to
do is they're going to go and say, all right, well, that's the data. What's wrong with our model?
That's right.
That's an excellent point.
Tweak the model.
Yeah. Yeah. That being said, there have been times where our models have come in and said, I don't think that data can be right. You know, and we've got these, there's this measurement of a magnetic monopole back in the late 70s, early 80s, which nobody can disqualify the measurement, but the theory says magnetic monopoles don't exist. So while it sits there, I mean, people have tried to replicate it and everything.
That's
and
right.
So there's reason to question the legitimacy of
but
it, even though
have,
we can't explain.
When you have reproducibility,
correct, yes,
and you're able to
yes,
replicate
yes.
the data, which the ENCODE scientists are putting out publication after publication after
correct,
publication
yeah.
of functionality.
And there's other studies that are independently confirming the results of the ENCODE
right.
project. Right.
I just want to make a question or a statement about functionality. You know, it's to me, it's curious how the ENCODE project is estimating functionality in this respect, that whenever you assay for function, you're assaying in a particular system that's looking for a particular type of function, right? And so most biological organisms function in a variety of different environments and systems with stimuli. And so if you think about all of the different epigenetic switches that can be flipped for something to be turned on or off, it seems like that whatever functional assays we're using to employ how much function is there in the genome would still be limited in a very sense of the system we're employing to assay the function.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes. And so that, in other words, you're saying there could be much more
I'm
function.
Saying that the functionality is probably much higher and that
yes.
for whatever reason, we just don't have the sophistication to assay the breadth of the functionality.
Well, and that's why many of the ENCODE scientists would say, even though we measured 80% functionality, we think that that number will actually trend up higher
mm-hmm. yeah.
for the reasons you point out. Another criticism of Grar's model is the way in which he calculated rates of deleterious mutations. He calculated it based on deleterious mutations in protein-coding genes.
Oh, that's just crazy.
Right. and there's other regions of the genome, like regulatory regions, regions that would be involved in determining three-dimensional structure, protein-binding regions that can actually tolerate a greater degree of mutation and still retain functionality. So his method of determining the deleterious mutation rates is actually suspect. Now, on top of that, his results are not that unreasonable either. Let's say you have a requirement of about 15 children, you know, plus, you know, approximately per couple to maintain constant population sizes. Well, for most of human history, you know, people didn't have effective birth control or birth control at all. People had a lot of kids, and a lot of those kids never made it to adulthood. And so to have that kind of a birth rate to remain a constant population size, I think isn't incompatible with probably much of human history. And then also another observation is, I think as a creationist slash intelligent design advocate of some sorts, I would argue that there's probably a percentage of the human genome that is actually non-functional, and that is actually important for the very reason that Dan Grar points out, that you have to have a region of the genome that isn't functional that can absorb the effects of mutation. And in fact, there are other scientists who've actually suggested that very thing. And I've written some Today New Reasons to Believe articles a few years ago about mutational buffering being potentially a function for parts of the the genome that are quote-unquote junk DNA.
So Fuzz, do you think of molecular buffering as different than sort of redundancies? Or would they be sort of the same grouping?
I would see those as two things that are interrelated but distinct functions.
Because, you know, redundancies are probably there in many instances for the buffering against harmful mutations, right? And so sort of a backup system built into the organism so the organism can continue to thrive if a particular gene gets hit by a somatic mutation.
So,
I mean, to me, it's a question of, well, what type of molecular buffering do you need other than that type of molecular buffering?
Well, I mean, if you think of mutations happening randomly, then you're going to get just mutations that take place. But if you have a certain proportion of the genome that is just there as a buffer, then some of those mutations will occur in those regions, and that will kind of mitigate the mutational load in the genome, which, I mean, in a sense...
I guess another way of asking the question or making the point I'm trying to make is that buffers have functions.
Yes, that was, and that's my point. That's the
okay.
I was making it inelegantly.
Sorry.
But thank you. So in other words, even if you took Grar's work at face value, he actually is identifying function for the junk DNA.
That's right.
And so even if you just said Grar's right, it's only 15%. Well, then he's actually shown very nicely that there's a rationale for a creator to have a genome with that amount of junk DNA because it's serving as a mutational buffer.
Yeah.
So, you know, he doesn't win, even if he does win. And then, you know, finally, and this is a point that you guys have alluded to, and that is, you know, it's fine and dandy, to your example, Jeff, about the monopole, it's fine and dandy to say, wait a minute, that results doesn't seem to match our theory. So let's go ahead and do a little bit more work to see if that result stands up. Well, this is what has happened, not just by ENCODE scientists, but other scientists have gone off and done work on the genome and keep coming back with the same result that regions are functional. And I wrote an article about protein binding in genomes, and that protein binding is not random, which is one of the criticisms of the ENCODE project critics, but it seems to be highly targeted. And in fact, to have non-random binding is actually problematic. It causes what's known as interference effects and titration effects that really create problems. I remember debating a couple of years ago P.Z. Myers at North Dakota State University on Darwin Day, and
just the Feringula blogger.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
and during the interchange, the ENCODE project came up, and he and I went back and forth on the ENCODE project. And it's interesting, P.Z. Myers made the same statement. Look, if the ENCODE project is correct, then key ideas in evolutionary theory can't be right. And I said to P.Z. Myers, I said, but if you're correct that a vast proportion of the genome is functional, then from a biochemical framework, your claims don't make sense. Because to have 50 to 75% of the genome transcribed, to have large levels of random protein binding biochemically is absurd, because it would create so much interference and compromise the functioning of the genome, and it's so energetically expensive and wasteful that you would think, even from an evolutionary perspective, evolution would weed all that out. And so I said to him, my intuition as a biochemist is what you're saying can't be correct either. It's
inconsistent from within the evolutionary paradigm itself in some respects, within part of the evolutionary paradigm, right? Not the part that Grar's arguing from.
I'm curious, how did he respond?
He just dismissed it.
Okay.
But you know, it's like...
He
dismissed it, but what's interesting is a couple of years later, a paper was published that basically confirmed my intuition,
where they
experimentally demonstrated that protein binding isn't random in the genome. There's very little off-target protein binding that takes place.
Well, it's like the 90% of transcripts in the cell are non-coding RNA transcripts, right? And for a very long time, we failed to recognize the significance of those non-coding RNAs. And now there's over a dozen different types of non-coding RNAs that function in different regulatory pathways and at different times under different systems of stimulus and reactions.
I'm going to bring this all to a close here and just say, you know, it's really weird to me because it's almost as if when you look at the ENCODE project critics that we're in some kind of bizarro world version of science where it's not the data that's evaluating the theory, it's the theory that's evaluating the data. And this is a very dangerous trend, I think,
absolutely,
that compromises science. But AJ, I was going to drop this just for the time for time's sake because we've gone on quite a bit of time here. But because you're here, I'm going to bring this up. This is what Dan Grar says in a popular article written up describing his the work in his paper. So he's quoted at the very end of that article this way: "We need to know the functional fraction of the human genome in order to focus biomedical research on the parts that can be used to prevent and cure disease. There is no need to sequence everything under the sun. We need only to sequence those regions that are functional." So, AJ, take it away. How would you react to that, Dan Grar's?
Well, okay. I think that, you know, it kind of ties into the news break that we did last week on the CRISPR genome editing of the human embryos. And in that paper's introduction, it talks about there being 10,000 monogenic diseases, which is pretty high number. I mean, I was surprised by that number, but that basically means that there's at least 10,000 different dysfunctions in human health, normal human health, that are related to a single gene, monogenic, right? And that's just the ones that we've identified. But I kind of think of it in this way, that how many of those mutations that happen actually have a redundant system in place so that single mutations aren't affecting us, right? And so when you think of it that way, you've at least doubled, if not tripled that, just at a functional exome or protein coding, because there, again, it's 10,000 monogenic things that have been identified, so not even necessarily regulatory mutations. But anyway, so I would just offer that. And also, you know, I the paper that I spoke on last week, the one on CRISPR editing of human embryos, and this one, they always call into question for me, what is our basis for comparison and analysis when we're talking about something in the genome? And recently on Facebook, I've highlighted somebody else's blog from Stat News that was quoting a couple of human genomics researchers, the ones that think that the genome's much more functional than Grar thinks. And they're saying that the completion of the human genome still isn't at even really 95%, although George Church was being somewhat generous, I think, in making his margin of completion only lacking 4 to 8%, 4 to 9%. The other researcher said about 8%, which was in line with the estimations that I made. But I'm basically writing another blog on the state of the human genomic project, right? Because the human genome, despite claims that it was finished first draft in 2001, like you led off with, finished to the Human Genome Project goals in 2003, which was really only 95% completion of the sort of gene relevant portions, that was probably completed in 2003. But what we've been noticing as we keep having new releases of the Human Genome Reference genome is that the gaps aren't shrinking. I mean, if you go back to the database that the paper of the CRISPR human embryo researchers were using, they were using something called Human Genome 19 or Genome Reference Number 37, Build 37. That was actually a February 2009. And if you look at the February 2009 human genome, there's, I think, somewhere between 300 and 400 gaps still in the genome. If you look at the most current one, which is Reference Genome 38.11, that number of gaps has actually grown to 800. And so this first draft, the current build 38, is actually the first build that includes centromeric regions. And so centromeric regions are ones that the original Genome Project never went after, right? Because it was part of something called heterochromatin, not euchromatin. But the paradigm in 2003 was the euchromatin is going to be what's important because that's where our genes are, that's where the proteins are. But as we continue to sequence into the heterochromatic regions, we're being surprised by functional pseudogenes, by functional genes, by more non-coding RNAs that we know have regulatory functions. So the truth is, we are, many people, like Garrar, I think, and other people are making assumptions that are heavily theory-laden, and they're saying, we can go in, we understand this well enough, we understand it well enough to assess it and manipulate it, and I would just say, hold on a minute, when we're starting to talk about actually altering the human genome at the embryonic level, we don't know it well enough, right? And it's good science that will stop bad science from leading us into a crisis situation or into a situation that we don't want to see come true from some science fiction movie.
Well, I mean, it's really disturbing because, in a sense, Garrar is not only doing science backwards, but then he's taking a position where he's advocating a view that the theory basically dictates what experiments we should or shouldn't do. And in the process, he's adopting a position that's stultifying science, which is ironic because that is the major concern against intelligent design and creationism is that that position stultifies science. Well, here is an example where this extreme commitment to the evolutionary paradigm could actually stultify science, as you're pointing out.
How is this going to play out? Where are we now?
Well, I think over time, I think the ENCODE project results are going to stand up, you know, and who knows what the final percentage of functionality will be. But, you know, I've not seen anything that suggests that the ENCODE project results are invalid, you know, and I have seen evolutionary biologists bully scientists who are working in genomics to actually be a lot more hesitant to ascribe function or to make claims about function. But the fact of the matter is, I think the data will win out at the end of the day, and I think the data will show that most of the human genome is functional, and that for those parts that are not quote-unquote functional, there'll be a rationale for why those parts are there. You know, something that you said some time back that I've co-opted.
Excellent.
And that is, you know, we really are in our infancy in understanding the human genome. And I think there is an appropriate posture in light of that where we want to be careful about making, you know, I think, claims about really what the genome is telling us about the question of origins and what the genome is telling us about the nature of how our genetic information is actually expressed. We want to be very careful about drawing conclusions. And in a sense, this is somewhat of my complaint against our friends at BioLogos and people that are evolutionary creationists, is a lot of the arguments for common descent are built around an understanding of the human genome that is really a minimalistic understanding. And that is, we learn more and more about the genome, the more complex and the more elegant, the more sophisticated it is, and the less that those arguments for common descent actually stand up, in my view.
Hmm. Fuzz, I know it's possible for one person to have the right view as opposed to a lot of people having the wrong view, but just for people to get an appreciation for the scope of the ENCODE project, and I know you alluded to the resources earlier, and people, we encourage people to go back and take a look. I remember at the time the ENCODE project came out, and I believe it was in two phases, if I'm not mistaken, phase one and then phase two. And for some reason, the number 450 comes to mind. So it was a very large number of scientists
This
involved.
Criticism that the ENCODE project was poorly conceived and that, you know, and things like that is really unfair because the project was inaugurated by Francis Collins shortly after the human genome
draft came out. Yep.
Was quote unquote completed.
Drafted. No, it was drafted in 2001, and that's when ENCODE was launched.
To come up with a program to identify functional elements in the human genome. And so there was a pilot phase where they took 1% of the human genome and they developed a set of assays, and they basically analyzed that 1%, and they showed in that pilot phase that they could pull this off. And they then went into phase two, and that phase two involved a consortium of 450 scientists. I'm not sure how many laboratories off the top of my head were involved, But the overall cost of phase one and phase two is about $500 million, which is like a quarter of the cost of, it was $3.2 billion.
For the human genome.
So for, you know, whatever, one-sixth the price, we're able to actually come to the table with a pretty impressive initial assessment of functional elements in the human genome. And phase three is still continuing. So I thought it was a well-thought-out project where they developed assays. They did a pilot phase. They showed they could pull it off. There's a consortium of scientists that are working collaboratively to produce these results. So it's not like they've gone off half-cocked. And these are some of the best minds in the world that are working on these on this problem. So, I mean, to argue that this group of scientists is incompetent, they don't have basic understanding of evolutionary biology, yada, 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 is really
it's a personal agenda.
It's a personal agenda.
Not a scientific evaluation.
I think it's a very unfair criticism to, I think, exceptional scientists that are doing work that is driving human knowledge forward at a very impressive rate and to a very impressive extent.
I wonder if in 5 years, Fuzz, if we're going to be sitting here thinking, wow, we were grossly underestimating the complexity of the human genome, even more than we're alluding to how complex it may be.
You know, that would be my, if I had to bet my rent money, that's where I would bet.
We're diploid organisms. What happens if we're only estimating 80% of a system that really has a capacity for 160% functionality because we're diploid organisms?
Yep.
Wow. What if the complexity is that great?
A little too complex for me to figure out right now, but I appreciate the discussion. Thanks to each of you for stimulating my mind. Hopefully you on the listening side have been stimulated to go on and share what you've learned here to the glory of God. Thanks to all. All right, that's going to wrap it up. Okay, we will go back and share all of this within our circles of influence. You know how to stay up to date with the scientists on their social media pages. On behalf of the team here, Fuzz, Jeff, and AJ, this is Joe Aguirre. Thank you for your support. We'll see you next time on Scientifica.
We'd like to thank our monthly partners for making this broadcast possible. If you're not a monthly partner or would like information about becoming one, please go to reasons.org/monthly partners. Also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where you can join the conversation about the latest scientific discoveries, headlines, and their apologetic value.